Today on Against the Grain, the anti-abortion movement has deeply shaped our era, and not just because of the repeal of Roe v. Wade. As scholar of the right, Carol Mason argues, it also helped provide a gateway to the growth of the authoritarian right by normalizing violent rhetoric and political violence while exporting ideas and tactics to the right abroad. She discusses the evolution of the anti-abortion movement to the present. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. What role has the anti-abortion movement played in shaping the far right today? That's the subject of Carol Mason's From the Clinics to the Capitol, How Opposing Abortion Became Insurrectionary, which examines the confluence of the authoritarian right and the anti-abortion movement. Mason is professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky, as well as faculty affiliate at the UC Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies, and she's written 4 books about the rise of the right since the 1960s. Carol, can you remind us of how the anti-abortion movement grew in this country and the circumstances that led to its rise?
Abortion was basically criminalized in the United States until the late 1960s, where there were efforts to start to decriminalize it. And part of the impetus for doing that was health reasons, things like the German measles epidemic, which caused some sort of deformities, birth defects, they used to call them, and also the scare of thalidomide, which was actually prescribed to pregnant folks and also resulted in some catastrophic birth defects, again, using a term that was of the time. And so there was an effort to liberalize abortion laws on various state levels, and the people who were forefront in that were doctors. But also there was a humanitarian element, and the women's movement, the feminist movement, very much argued in favor of abortion rights as a way to have self-determination and a way to ensure that women could plot their own lives without being held hostage to fertility. So that fertility control was something that feminists really wanted to push forward, and they wanted to repeal the existing laws and not just reform them, but to actually say there should be no restriction whatsoever. Well, 1973 Supreme Court decision of Roe v. Wade was actually a compromise, and I think that often it gets depicted as a legalization of abortion, but what it really did was it standardized restrictions on abortion on a national level. And so people who were opposed to that were at the beginning largely Catholic. The anti-abortion movement was largely a Catholic, white, and male-led organization. And when the Supreme Court decision liberalized abortion law, there became more of a coalition between evangelicals and Catholics at that point. So there has been a whittling away of this right to terminate one's pregnancy. And there have been sort of legal efforts to roll back the triumph of Roe versus Wade. Some people saw it as a triumph. I see it as a compromise. And there were also other people who wanted to not rely on the law. And they felt that the law was too incremental and that they should take matters into their own hands. And so some of those direct action and grassroots folks decided to protest access to abortion in ways that they called rescue. And the rescue movement shared with it a kind of Vietnam story. In other words, people who had come back from fighting Vietnam were looking for a kind of cause, and the white power movement benefited from these folks looking for a cause because some folks felt like they had fought communism over there and that they should fight communism here. And what they read as communism were immigrants and some other people. So a historian named Kathleen Ballou has talked about this Vietnam story in regard to the white power movement in a book called Bring the War Home. And I sort of trace out a kind of parallel story, Vietnam story, in which folks who felt that abortion was their Vietnam, they started to take up this cause. And so some scholars suggest that that proves that the early anti-abortion movement in the grassroots section was progressive, but I don't quite see it that way because I've looked at primary materials and read what those leaders have said. And so we have kinds of various movements in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s in which we have people, elected officials and politicians trying to curtail reproductive rights in a mainstream capacity. And then we have these folks who had become increasingly militant to try and curtail those rights and the access to it. So that resulted in the 90s was a really a huge turning point in which the grassroots effort really became violent. And it started off with violence against clinics, in other words, attacks on the buildings themselves, bombings and whatnot, and then it escalated into bombs that were not only meant to disrupt and sabotage the clinic itself as a building, but also to cause casualties. And so some of the bombs that were deployed were actually anti-personnel bombs. And then people started to kill for life. They started to murder people. And I look at the radicalized abortion foes who discuss how killing physicians and abortion clinic workers and reproductive health care professionals is justifiable homicide. And so that was a huge sort of explosion in the 1990s. And then we come into the 2000s where we get the Tea Party, we get a kind of new assault on reproductive freedom, and I'll just flash forward to the Dobbs decision of 2022.
We'll talk about this in depth as we go through the hour, but I wonder if you could say in a nutshell why you think we should see the anti-abortion movement as linked to white nationalism, because the story that you've just been recounting and reminding us of, the rise of this anti-abortion movement becoming more and more militant, in a sense, it has been framed, I think, for many people as an episode of the past, and then we see the rise of the right now in all its different sort of noxious forms. But you're saying that, and you're arguing that, the anti-abortion movement and white nationalism have often been linked and that that connection has frequently been overlooked.
Absolutely. I see the white power movement, the patriot militia movement, and the radicalized anti-abortion movement as parallel and sometimes intersecting movements. When I make this argument, I'm very careful to let people know that I'm not saying that everyone who opposes abortion is a racist. So I very much, in making this argument showing the connections and the parallelisms between the white power movement and the anti-abortion movement and the militia movement. I don't want to say that they're all one and the same, but here's where it sometimes gets sticky. Because currently, it's really important to realize that in this historical moment, we have a multicultural, multiracial right. And many anti-abortion materials right now claim to oppose abortion as an extension of racial justice or civil rights or even abolitionism has come into favor. So what I do is I look closely at those campaigns, and I find that the use of civil rights rhetoric and anti-slavery rhetoric is not the same as aiming for an egalitarian society. Often, instead, those groups want a society based on what they call God's law and in a natural order, which is, in their viewpoint, naturally and a God-sanctioned patriarchy.
Talk more about that, about the kind of deployment of civil rights rhetoric and imagery, evocations of slavery and anti-slavery in casting white women and including white men as victims.
Yes, opposing abortion has portrayed women as victims of abortion and also portrays men as victims as well. We here in the United States tend to see abortion as a clash of absolutes, which is the famous phrase by Lawrence Later, I think. So one of my research questions was, how do people talk about abortion in other countries? And in particular, I looked at Ireland, Russia, and the U.S. And at the time I was researching and writing this book, Ireland was going through the process of decriminalizing abortion, and Russia was becoming more and more anti-abortion, and the U.S. was on the brink of recalling Roe v. Wade. And so what I found was that the U.S. has, since the 1970s, sort of exported an anti-abortion rhetoric as well as tactics and sometimes funds and personnel. And from the 1990s onward, they especially exported the idea that women are hurt by abortion and need to be protected from it. And in this kind of story, abortion becomes something much more than a medical procedure used to terminate a pregnancy. In this story that got exported abroad from the U.S., from U.S. organizations, abortion is seen as an evil industry full of quacks and demons instead of like one aspect of reproductive health care. And over the last few decades, more and more these stories got fiercer, depicting abortion procedures as not only damaging and injurious, but actually torture. And it depicts people who get abortions as under the spell of depraved and satanic people. And so it's very powerful stuff. It doesn't rely naturally on rational argument. It relies on feeling and emotion. And those comparisons of abortion as Holocaust or slavery or a lack of civil rights really pushes this gory imagery that has that emotional effect. And so what I found is that the people who are pushing those comparisons really are trying to convince people to vote for particular candidates. And so while they're not necessarily electoral organizations, they do have a direct or indirect consequence on elections. The idea that white people and their children, white people's offspring, are endangered is part of this story. And it has been there since the 70s. I think some of the people, for example, the leader of Human Life International, has always sort of exported anti-abortion ideas and influence to overseas. So these ideas have been there since the 70s, but they've really become amplified today. And so I want to give you an example. I have a quotation from the leader of Human Life International that comes from a book that was published in 1988, but was something that he said, you know, even a little bit earlier. And he said that Muslims are taking over Western Europe. And regarding South Africa, he said, and this is published as early as 1988, but I think he was saying these things earlier because he was certainly active back then. This is a quotation, contraceptive whites are no longer replacing themselves, having barely two children per completed family. The blacks average 5, the coloreds 3.29, and the Asiatics 2.7. For the whites, the handwriting is on the wall, end quote. And so even so far back as the 80s, people who promote anti-abortion ideas abroad are trying to convince people that white people in particular are endangered.
Right. And of course, we have seen so much of that in recent years, white racist anxieties around the idea of white replacement of white people by people of color. I should say that I'm speaking with scholar of the right, Carol Mason, author of From the Clinics to the Capitol, How Opposing Abortion Became Insurrectionary. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Another thing that we have seen intensify in recent years is pronatalist anxieties about women having enough babies, embodied in very sort of strange ways by Elon Musk in the United States, but much more widespread on the right. Can you talk about this pronatalist dimension, which I presume is pronatalist for some people, and the way that pregnancy and having children is bound up with nationalism and white nationalism?
Right. Well, in the book, I talk about specifically in the case of Irish women and in their situation there, I drew from historians who detailed how women who opted to have abortions when it was criminalized in Ireland really felt that they had given up their sense of motherhood and their place in the nation. So nationalism and motherhood have always gone hand in hand. And I think that people who oppose abortion sort of feed into this idea that those people who become pregnant, who choose not to continue that pregnancy, are somehow betraying their nation. So I write about that in the book. And I think that the idea of natalism is really amazing. The first natalism conference was in Austin, here in the United States, in December of 2023, and that I think it's called NatalCon or something like that, and that Kevin Dolan, I've understood, was sort of an organizer of that conference, and that he has these very eugenicist kinds of ideas. And so what I can tell you from my research is that what's now being expressed really forthrightly as pronatalism has been a kind of subtext for a lot of right-wing campaigns and movements. So even though we can say that the first pronatalist conference was held in Austin of 2023, the impulse to birth more babies has been percolating a lot in a variety of ways since before the turn of the millennium. And I can see three strains of pronatalism that emerge from existing groups opponents of abortion. And I talk about some of these in the book, From the Clinics to the Capitol. And the first strain of pronatalism I see is a really male supremacist strain of pronatalism. That the Promise Keepers, for example, back in 1997, they originated, and they were a group of people who were mobilizing, in particular, Christian men, and telling Christian men that they had been demasculinized and that they should take back the family and take back the role of decision maker and head of the family from their wives, to do it compassionately, they say, Christianly, in a Christian manner, they say. But so the Promise Keepers is this very male-centered, male supremacist kind of group. But what were their promises? There were seven of them back in 1997, but just right after they organized, anti-abortion groups added an eighth promise to them. And that eighth promise, they went to the Promise Keepers rallies and they convinced people to add another promise, which was, I will not kill my children. And so this idea of not killing my children as a man's promise to his family and to his nation, this was sort of the beginning of the Genocide Awareness Project that grew out of the Center for Bioethical Reform. And that argued that abortion constituted genocide. But it blurred who it was that was being made extinct through this so-called abortion as genocide. And I think very often we get the idea that the unborn that they talk about is implicitly racialized as white. And so around the same time, David Lane, who was a white power movement person convicted of killing, of murder, he wrote these 14 words: we must secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. And so so we see this kind of early male supremacist element of, you know, wanting to have women raise the birth rate. Groups that grew out of that Center for Bioethical Reform, such as Created Equal, perpetuates this idea that men are under attack by women. And so their anti-abortion initiative is also about men taking back their rightful place. And so this push to protect the white person's birth rate, I think, is kind of one element of pronatalism. And then there's a kind of nativist element of pronatalism. And I sort of, in my book, I illustrate this sentiment with an artifact that was distributed in Indiana, I think, and in Missouri. And it had a picture of immigrants crossing the road with a slash and a circle and a slash through it, as if, like, don't do this. And what it said was, send them back. They can't make white babies. And so we have this idea circulated by a notorious white supremacist group called the National Alliance. And again, it's this idea of, we need to promote the birth of white people, and immigrants should be sent back because they can't make the right kind of baby. And then really quickly, I think the third strain of pronatalism I see, and that I write about in the book, is a kind of transnational pronatalism, and it's an aspect of the rise of the global right, and there's this fear of a demographic decline. And you mentioned the great replacement theory, but there's also lots of discussion around this in conferences led by the World Congress of Families. And they've put out media such as A Demographic Winter is a film version of this, in which they basically show cinematographically white kids actually disappearing from a landscape. And again, the idea is that we need to replace children who are being disappeared.
Speaking of the global right, how do these ideas intersect with the far right's fixation with trans people and queer folks who obviously do not conform to their rigid notions of gender and gender hierarchies?
In a lot of ways, if you're familiar with the rhetoric and the discourse of opposing abortion throughout the decades, when there was this idea of anti-gender, we see a kind of the same kind of tactics and rhetoric repackaged in some way, and especially around the idea of protecting our children, right? And so the anti-gender forces are suggesting some of the same things about the trans community as anti-abortionists have suggested about what they call an abortion industry, right? And what both of those kind of have in common is, one, a kind of imaginary of dismemberment, of goriness. So, for example, the stories that our current president once reiterated, that kids are going into public schools and that they're being subjected to surgeries so that they go in as a girl and come out as a boy. That this idea that public schools are places where there's some evil, nefarious secret to have operations on children, that this has a same kind of depravity sensibility to it as the way that abortion has been promoted or portrayed by anti-abortionists, that it is something evil, that it's something barbaric, that it's something that is about the bodily dissolution of people and of children in particular. And so we get a lot of intersection there, and it also intersects with the Save the Children campaign that circulates among QAnon conspiracists.
Please tell us more about that, because it is a continuity that has played itself out over time, but seems very pronounced right now in all sorts of ways, from the Pizzagate fixations to, you know, theories around Jeffrey Epstein, and in which maybe Donald Trump won't escape. Who knows?
Yes. Yeah, so for those people who don't know what Pizzagate is, this was a precursor to the QAnon conspiracism, in which people suggested that Democrats and Hillary Clinton had some kind of space in the basement of a particular pizza parlor, and that this was where human trafficking of children and into sex slavery happened. And so this was, of course, a debunked conspiracy theory, but that fear, which, you know, anybody who has a child can understand the fear. It's really an emotional register. That fear of, you know, my child might be endangered, I think has really been harnessed by this. And the QAnon conspiracies purport that there is a group of depraved Democrats and Hollywood elites and other people who actually not only have pedophilic parties and sex rings, but also that there's something even satanic in some versions of this story, something depraved, something actually done by demons or to foster demonic rites. And so this kind of imagery and this kind of fear-mongering and this kind of affect, this kind of emotion, really pulsates through all three of those kinds of depravity stories. You know, what it means to have an abortion, what it means that it's not individual people who want to terminate a pregnancy and they're making this their own private medical decision, but that there's actually a mandate to make women have abortions in the most bloody way possible. And so I've looked at some films such as Abortion, Doctrine of Demons, to look at how they portray abortion as something that is done by and for satanic and demonic and otherwise depraved people. So that's really out in their media. And then if you think about sort of just regular culture, there are some historians such as Jennifer Holland and certainly some journalists who have looked at the annual Halloween haunted houses that are sponsored by particular churches in the South and in the West, in which people are taken, young kids are taken through this haunted house. And among all the dangerous things that they see is that they see somebody having an abortion. And they even have, specific directions to, like, go get ground beef and put it in a bowl so that people can see the bloodiness of it. And there's a demon there. Like, they have scripts and one of the players is literally a demon. And so generations of young people have been brought up on this idea that abortion is something that's completely bloody and dismembering and about killing children, and that the only people who do that are people who are as depraved or duped by depraved individuals. And I feel like this kind of imagery and this kind of fear has migrated from anti-abortion discourse into QAnon conspiracism and also the anti-gender aspects of things.
Carol Mason is my guest. She's author of From the Clinics to the Capitol, How Opposing Abortion Became Insurrectionary. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Carol, do you think what you've just been discussing about this sort of fixation about the exploitation of children, the trafficking of children, things that are even more sort of supernatural to do with demons and children, that some of that can explain the participation of women in the far right? Because if you also look at the anti-abortion movement, which seems at its heart to be deeply reactionary for women, but you had many participants in those movements who are female as well. How do you think about that dimension of these movements that may reinforce this idea of a natural hierarchy with women below men, but often have female participants and female leaders, as does MAGA?
It's a great question, and I spend an entire chapter on this question in some ways. I look specifically at what notable anti-abortion activist women have written by and for other abortion foes. And I think it's really important to read what they wrote. Very often, women get involved in right-wing organizations or conservative and far-right organizations, not because necessarily they are driven by the ideology, but they are driven by the sociability. In other words, they don't, you know, hate is a learned thing. Hatred is something that you learn. You don't immediately have, you're taught how to hate someone or suspect someone or dislike someone. And so it's not as if people have some kind of racist idea and then they want to join a white supremacist movement. No, on the contrary, they get connected with people in innocuous ways. And so the first stage of recruiting for right-wing movements is something simple like a church picnic or a gym. Mixed martial arts right now in various gyms is a place where right-wingers are recruiting young men. And so you get involved in things, and women in particular, I'm thinking especially of Kathleen Blee's excellent work on right-wing women and women in the Klan in particular. She says, you know, these women go in not necessarily believing racist ideas, but that the ideology comes after a kind of inclusion in a community.
Well, then in terms of those sorts of ideas and kind of pulling these threads together historically, the rise of the anti-abortion movement and then the explosion on the scene, at least in the media, of right-wing groups that we have seen more recently, but actually trying to look back and trace what has intersected with what has fed into what, the ways that the anti-abortion movement has been a way that others on the far right, say white nationalists, have recruited people. How do you see the parallel growth or interpenetration of the anti-abortion movement in its more violent incarnations and the kind of militias that certainly have proliferated and shown themselves in really nasty ways in recent years, but obviously have been powerful forces well beyond the present? How do you see the growth of these far-right white nationalist militias and the anti-abortion movement in its most militant forms?
I look retroactively at that question. There are a lot of really great journalists who are looking at the right here and now and sort of tracing how Patriot Front and Groyper and some other far-right groups are actively at anti-abortion events and trying to recruit. There are some folks who are doing that kind of on the ground, here in the moment kind of research right now. What I tried to do was to show how through shared tactics, ideology, and sometimes personnel, these two movements were parallel and sometimes intersecting. And one of the persons that I think that people in recent years have understood show this intersection is someone named Scott Roeder, who succeeded in killing physician George Tiller in 2009. It was revealed that he had been involved in both patriot militia groups and in anti-abortion movements since the 90s. I look at two particular people who also show these combined or this intersecting these intersecting movements. And one of them is Eric Rudolph, who's a convicted bomber. And I look at his work not only in the past, which I had done in my first book, which was called Killing for Life, where I asked, what does life mean if you can kill for it? I explored Eric Rudolph there. And then for this book, From the Clinics to the Capitol, I looked at Rudolph again. And there had been more research into his whereabouts and his movements since I had first written about him in the early 2000s. And there were some people who had shown that he had not only bombed these clinics in the South, but when he took a break from those bombings, he actually traveled west and was traveled in a likely way to some of these right-wing enclaves. I also looked at his prison writings. Eric Rudolph has written a lot of writings in prison, and they are collected and posted on the internet at the Army of God website. And I sort of read through those with a fine-tooth comb. And I will just share one nugget with you. He wrote a novel called All Enemies, Foreign and Domestic. And in that novel, which was, a fairly recent writing of his, he can't publish them because I think it's illegal for him to profit from this as a felon. But I thought it was very interesting that his villain in the novel is not a person who is providing abortion, but is a transgender person. And so so it seems like Rudolph is sort of, his writings reflect the evolution of right-wing thought. The other person that I look at is a guy named Paul de Perry, who was not a violent person in the sense of, he wasn't a bomber, he didn't kill anybody, but he was a publisher. He was the editor of Life Advocate magazine, and he was also wrote many novels and nonfiction books himself. But he was very well connected. He was based in Oregon, and he was very well connected with right-wing organizations, not just conservative ones, but white nationalists and militia groups. And so I sort of detail that in my book, too, to show these connections.
Then taking things up to the present, where would you say the anti-abortion movement is now? Where does it fit in this spectrum of the right, including the right in power, now that they have successfully helped repeal Roe versus Wade?
Yeah, you would think that once that, you know, the dog caught the car that it was chasing, that it would like sort of lay down and relax a little bit. But by virtue of the fact that repealing Roe v. Wade wasn't enough, I think that the movement, or at least the radicalized part of the movement, has shown that opposing abortion has been a strategy, and that ending abortion has not been a goal as much as it's been a strategy to consolidate power. And so right now, I think that there is an awful lot of anti-abortion folks who are kind of flummoxed because a couple things have changed. Since the Dobbs decision, more than 60% of people who terminate their pregnancies do so with pills. And so what do they do? Who then is the abortionist? If you're going to target an abortionist and the abortionist is actually the person herself taking a pill, you know, you are the abortionist now. And so it changes things a lot from making the brick and mortar clinic the enemy. And yet we have this, what I understand is, increase in violence against clinics, and we also have an increase in how locals are being sort of deputized and encouraged to take matters into their own hands. to stop people from obtaining pills or from crossing a state border to obtain an abortion. And I think that's really a remarkable kind of legacy or culmination of the anti-abortion movement, at least of its radicalized part, where they, the radicals who were violent in the 90s, you know, sort of said, you need to take matters into your own hands and thwart the law. Now, the idea, I think that meshes really well with the overall wholesale rejection of the rule of law that we see among all factions of the right and that we are experiencing as citizens of the United States.
Let me end by asking you how what you call the visual politics of the anti-abortion movement and really of the right more broadly has changed since, say, the 1990s, the attacks on the clinics at that point. So in terms of the kind of imagery and propaganda that people are putting out, it has a different flavor in a way. Also, because some of these movements don't look the same as they did then. What does it look like now?
I pay special attention to the politics of visuals in my chapter on the anti-abortion group Created Equal, which is a group that goes on campuses. And they have these huge jumbotrons, even. They've gone into the digital mode, and not only big, you know, larger than life vinyl banners that purport products of abortion, but also like jumbotrons. And what I've seen happening in with this visual culture and this particular visual rhetoric is that it's not so much that the students are taken in by that. I think mostly today's students understand that those are misrepresentations. So there's no more idea of verisimilitude here. I think that that's really sort of downplayed, as opposed to what the gore and the horror of it is sort of played out in spatial terms as well as visual terms, so that at the edge of campus you get these signs that say warning, disturbing images, and then someone walks in a little further to the quad and you go like, your last chance to move back because you're going to see something disturbing. And so the students and the faculty's appetites are whetted. It's kind of like a horror movie where you get some teaser of violence to come. And so when you happen upon the actual group with their jumbotron, you know, you're already heightened up, and you're expecting violence and injury and horror. And you get that. And so it enrages passers-by. And that's the big difference that I see between the visual politics of yesteryear and now, because those visual politics are put in the service of trying to provoke physical altercations on campuses. And so they'll say, like, you can't touch anything, and they have line crossings. But inevitably, someone is going to be so upset by these images that they're going to try and flip over a lawn sign or do something like that. And I have seen on campuses this kind of goading of people into a physical altercation. I think there are at least two purposes for that. One of them is so that the anti-abortionists can sue somebody, either the organization or the individual or the university. And they have done this since 2010. They've sued people on campus, which gives them some money in which to recruit more people. And recruitment is another part of this. So they always have their body cams on. And so they show you these images of people who've been provoked and who are enraged by these these racialized, often racialized comparisons, and just sort of the goriness. Why do I need to confront this on my way to like geography class? And so those body cams become recruitment video that goes online. And basically what that shows is that the anti-abortionists are the ones under attack, right? They don't show how the whole thing was set up to provoke anger and violence, but they show just these supposedly well-meaning, pious, meek Christians as being assaulted or under verbal or physical attack by their opponents.
And of course, feeding into that trope, that enduring trope of the right, of virtuous people being the perennial victims. Carol Mason, we're out of time. Thank you so much for your time today.
I am so grateful. Thank you.
I've been speaking with Carol Mason. She's the author of From the Clinics to the Capitol, How Opposing Abortion Became Insurrectionary. She's professor of gender and women's studies at the University of Kentucky, faculty affiliate at the UC Berkeley Center for Right-Wing Studies, and author of four books about the rise of the right since the 1960s. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.